Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, Paul Waldman from the American Prospect will tell us why he thinks the media will need to change the way it covers President Trump by pressuring him to tell the truth or face getting steamrolled. Zoe Carpenter from The Nation magazine will join us to discuss the Senate confirmation hearing on Betsy DeVos and why Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of Education didn't come close to making the grade. Writer and advocate for universal basic income, Scott Santons, will be here to explain how a Social Security for All plan would keep U.S. citizens out of poverty. America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, will tell us why New Jersey Senator Cory Booker has ruined his chance of becoming the next Democratic superstar. Michael Brooks from the Majority Report will be here to run down some of the biggest news stories of the past week. Hey, if you aren't a member of our podcast, go to rofpodcast.com to sign up. You'll have the option of signing up for a free hour of our show or becoming a member and getting the three-hour show without commercials. Plus bonus content you won't hear anywhere else. Go to rofpodcast.com and sign up. That's rofpodcast.com. You're going to need independent media during the Trump years, and we'll be here. And don't forget, you can now gift the Ring of Fire podcast to a friend or family member. It's a great way to support independent progressive media. Joining me to run down the news of the week is my co-host here at Ring of Fire Radio and host of the new show, America's Lawyer, Mike Papantonio. So, Pap, now we have an official President Trump, as it were. I'm still going to refer to him as the President Electoral out of consideration of his win. But next up, we start thinking about 2018 and 2020. And in terms of electoral politics, but one of the things obviously is talking about Democrats both not only fighting Trump, but also presenting a proactive view of a political vision. And part of that is, you know, fighting Trump on the ACA and pushing for single payer expansion. But, you know, just a week and a half ago, not even, we had guys like Cory Booker, who has been positioning for 2020, who in the past, I think people have been rather dubious about because of his relationships with Wall Street and with the school privatization movement. And he gave us, maybe it was a little bit over a week ago, but I don't know if we talked about it, a perfect example of what is problematic with a guy like Cory Booker, who does a great job going and arguing against Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, important to put that marker down. But then the next night, in the dead of the night, votes against, granted, non-binding resolution, but an amendment that would have called for reimportation of Canadian drugs. He joins 11 other Democrats who voted against it, but he came from one of the bluest states. And of course, they all had something in common, these 12 Democrats.
Well, let me make a prediction. Cory Booker is yesterday's news. He's a train wreck. You know, the theory is, yeah, I do something stupid, but people are going to forget. We won't let this forget. Nobody's going to forget what Cory Booker did here. Nobody is. The social media is killing him. Yeah. I mean, he is a dead man walking. And you know what? That's a good thing, because you'd rather deal with it now. They were trying to make Cory Booker into the next Obama and this great visionary. Yeah, you know, Cory Booker goes and talks about Sessions. I mean, who's not going to agree with him? I mean, Cory Booker's always out on these issues that are just, you know, nobody's going to disagree with, because it doesn't cost him any money. But the issue dealing with drugs and being able to let mom and pop buy drugs rather than, you know, paying a 3,000% markup, just having it shipped in from Canada. Cory Booker lines up with the fat cats that have put him where he is now. You have to go back and understand Cory Booker. Cory Booker was invented by Wall Street. Sam, he was totally invented by Wall Street. He's up there in pharmaceutical heaven, where all the big pharmaceutical companies are. They invented Cory Booker. And so they say to Cory Booker, well, now make sure, Cory, that you're out on the touchy-feely issues about social issues, like whether it's, you know, whether it's race or whether it's gender. Make sure you're out there on that. But, buddy, when it comes to the money shots, you want our $300,000 that we give you from the pharmaceutical industry, so don't vote against us. And let me tell you how outrageous, how I'm just so enraged by this. You have people out there that are deciding, should I buy my medication or should I pay my rent? Right. Should I buy medication or do I eat tonight? Should I be able to cut my pill in half so I can make it go twice the distance? Cory Booker knows that. And his argument about, oh, gee whiz, we had to be sure that we were gonna get safe products. Really? Really? Is there some epidemic in Canada that nobody's told me about where people are dying from pharmaceuticals that haven't been tested? Cory Booker is a fraud. And Cory Booker is a fraud, Sam, and we got to keep talking about Cory Booker, the fraud, because I don't want him to gain any momentum. I want him to be yesterday's news. I don't care if he's a senator up in New Jersey. I don't care. Let him stay there. But do not put this dangerous character on a national field.
And you know, we should just remind people that about 2 weeks ago, he voted for the Cures Act, which sounds great. But really what it does is it says we should spend money on cancer. We should spend money on a couple other diseases. It doesn't appropriate the money. The money may never get there. But what it also did is it relaxed standards. And you know this as well as anybody, Pap. It basically relaxed standards in terms of FDA safety, which you know is already Swiss cheese as it stands now, because you've got basically the industry doing their own reports. So if he was really concerned about drug safety in this country, he wouldn't be relaxing standards for the FDA 1 week and then the next week pretending that somehow Canada was like some type of backroom chemistry lab and we'd be getting all sorts of freaky stuff from Canada. But this is important. I mean, look. This is important. There's a couple of things that we can glean from this. I mean, aside from obviously specifically a guy like Cory Booker, keep an eye on Bob Casey as well, who voted this way, about 10 other Democrats who come from states that, you know.
Sam, I called Murray. I called both Murray and Casey because I wanted to see, are we going to do a show on them? On America's Lawyer on RT. And I said, look, send me something to defend what you've done. Mm-hmm. I haven't gotten anything from them. But I am going to absolutely decimate Cory Booker, Cantwell, Carper, Casey, Coons, Donnelly, Heinrich, Heitenkamp, all of these frauds. They know they have put mom and pop America in the position of, do I eat or can I buy my medication? And they're well aware of the fact that the Pfizers and the Mercks and the Johnson & Johnson and the Bayers, that they have marked up their products as high, in some instances, this is an unbelievable, as high as 6,000% on some of these medications. They know that, and they did this anyway. They don't deserve to be there with a big D behind their name. I don't have any confidence in Democrats to begin with, but they at least are trying to hide behind something that at least is a plausible argument that, gee whiz, I care for people. These people don't care for people. They care about money, and Cory Booker is all about money. We have got to stop the Cory Bookers before they completely destroy the only other party we have running right now besides the Republicans. I don't really care for either one of them, but you have to have at least two parties, and you're going to have Cory Booker decimate the Democratic Party because the discussions out there go online. He's already getting murdered in social media.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about healthcare that we saw this past week. Aside from Donald Trump taking the oath of the presidency, we saw a huge pushback by Democrats across the country over the past week and a half, fighting back against possible repeal of the Affordable Care Act. We'll also talk about President Obama's reauthorization of the National Defense Authorization Act, which had a little bonus in there for Donald Trump. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Pap, who has launched a new show on RT America called America's Lawyer. You can find out more at ringoffireradio.com. So, Pap, we were talking about Cory Booker and his betrayal of the Democratic Party and all the people who I think see him as some type of champion in refusing to allow for drug importation from Canada. But let's talk about a little bit about what Bernie Sanders had going on with the Our Revolution's Our First Fight, Our First Stand, I should say, where you had rallies organized by Bernie Sanders and like-minded folk, Our Revolution, across the country, scaring the heck out of Republican lawmakers when it came to the Affordable Care Act repeal. And the Republicans are in a bit of a box here because Donald Trump is going out there shooting his mouth off without knowing any of the details, promising things that would be great if he delivers, frankly, but basically writing checks that the Republican Party can't cash. And so they're completely confused as to where to go next. And well, it's a fascinating development.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating on so many levels. First of all, that Bernie Sanders is doing what he said he was going to do.
Yep.
He promised that he wasn't going to go away. He promised that he's going to keep the discussions about things like health care alive. He's doing it. He's one of these few politicians that, you know, when he says something, Sam, you can really believe it. He does it. And here's what I find interesting about it. Just weeks ago, when we had the Republicans trying to gut the ethics committee. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What changed their mind was political outrage. Everybody in the streets, just total outrage. It wasn't in the streets, but it was in social media. And they embarrassed the Democrats and the Republicans who were trying to make it to where there is no ethics. There's no such thing as an ethics violation anymore. Okay, that's what they're trying to do. Then we have the Cory Booker issue where he's lying to, we're seeing him as a fraud and he's committing fraud and social media is responding and it'll continue picking up heat there. Now we have the health care issue. All of this, if you go back and think about it, has been driven by what Bernie Sanders has made his pledge, keeping this revolution alive, to say there is no Democrat that's correct. There is no Democratic hero. There's no Republican hero. We simply have to call balls and strikes. And right now, that's what's happening with Bernie in the health care fight. I mean, this could pick up real momentum.
Yeah, and it's good. And certainly, I think the Republicans are they're chasing their own tail. We've got Health and Human Services, Tom Price, this past week said that he has not shared his plan. He doesn't want to flaunt his plan in his hearings. And simultaneously, the administration claiming that they have not included him in their plans to redesign or supposedly replace the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
But just absurd.
He's out there saying insurance for everyone. A car in every, two cars in every garage.
Listen, if we have insurance for everybody and deductibles are low,
he will be
and
the,
it's
he,
real insurance,
oh, the,
God bless.
God bless him. He will never go away as a great American leader if that happens.
Indeed. All right. Now let's talk a little bit about some parting gifts that President Obama left for Donald Trump. One was the NSA basically allowed for, via executive action, my understanding, that the NSA can now share raw intelligence across the spectrum of intelligence agencies just in time for Donald Trump and his organization to take over. But that's not all. Tell us about this NDAA provision.
Oh, my God. That's nothing compared to what Obama did two nights before Christmas while you were out drinking eggnog. Hopefully with, drinking eggnog or maybe asleep, you had Obama
on his, by executive order, signing into law something that is Section 2349 of the it's the Defense Authorization Bill, which, you know, it gives money to the defense. Okay, so we can pay for military. So what he did is created what is nothing less than a ministry of propaganda. Where what they do is they have the right to spend, the Department of Defense, Sam, has the right to spend $60 million spreading it out among people in social media that will attack anybody who has a criticism of government. In other words, RT is a great example. I do a show on RT called America's Lawyer. So if I say something about Wall Street, this Ministry of Propaganda has the right to come after me, spend money with places like maybe the Washington Post or Huffington Post or wherever they want to spend the money to do a hit story on me. They've already done it with Ed Schultz. They've done it with Tom Hartman. So we're going to start seeing it more and more. But Obama gave us that, Sam. Obama signed it just in time for Trump to take over. Now, he hasn't said one word about it, not one word, but I urge everybody, go online and look at this. Just look up Obama's Ministry of Propaganda. You will be shocked. He knew what he was doing. He's a constitutional lawyer himself, taught constitutional law. He just says, what we're going to do is now is allow the government to engage in propaganda, and we're going to make the decision on what's acceptable and not and is not acceptable about what somebody says about the U.S. government or Wall Street or pharmaceutical industry or fracking or whatever it may be. They're going to make the choice, and they're going to my prediction is a lot of money is going to go to the Washington Post, a lot of it's going to go to Huffington Post, a lot of it's going to go to any Amazon, anything that Bezos is involved with, because Bezos, as you know, has a huge government contract on computer security. So we're going to see all kinds of ugly things coming out of this. That's something that's part of Obama's legacy. And I'm not going to let that go. I'll be talking about that all of 2017, reminding this guy what he did in his last days in office.
Well, we're out of time, Pap. I'm sure you will be reminding everybody, and I appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, why the media needs to adapt during the Trump presidency or get steamrolled like they did in the general election. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Mainstream media's coverage of the general election could be classified as dismal at best. Time after time, Donald Trump was able to go unchallenged on lies and outrageous statements. Joining us now to talk about his piece in the American Prospect, "The News Media Has Got to Change or It'll Get Steamrolled by Trump," Paul Waldman. So, Paul, you've written a piece, and we're starting to see, you know, there's been a decent number of pieces like this, because the relationship of the press to the president, the now president in this instance, and the American public, it's probably never been more important. Let's start with that premise. Why is it so important that the press gets this right?
Well, because I think that, this has been obviously an extraordinary election where we have a candidate who really kind of broke all the rules, and oftentimes in ways that showed that that everything that we thought was true wasn't true. If you think about it from Trump's perspective for a moment, he probably thinks, and quite rightly to a great degree, that he can get away with anything, and that everything that people thought was true just doesn't apply to him. that not only things like the mechanics of campaigning, that you don't have to have a real ground operation, for instance, you don't have to have a complex campaign structure. You know, people said, oh, that would really be a problem for him, and it turned out it wasn't. He could just blow into town, have a big rally, and that would be enough. And it turned out that you could be abusive to the news media and they wouldn't really punish you for it. It turned out that he didn't really need to air a lot of campaign ads. It turned out that you could lie just promiscuously dozens of times every day. And even if the press pointed it out, it wouldn't really make that much of a difference. So all of these things that we thought were true turned out not to be true. And I think that, the news media was really shocked. And that's, I think, one of the best explanations that I've seen for the disparate treatment that Trump and Clinton got. The way that Clinton was hammered in a much more damaging way by the news media than Trump was. So what some people have suggested is that, journalists really thought that when it came to Trump, they would certainly give him what could be considered negative coverage, but it was a lot of just sort of about this crazy show that he was putting on. Whereas with Clinton, they thought they were really vetting the person who was going to be the president. And so they were much more serious about the criticisms that they made of her and the way that they kind of hammered again and again and again on the emails, because they assumed, as everyone did, and I'll admit I did too, that in the end she was going to win. So now we're left at this situation where, all of these things that the press thought it was doing just weren't really effective when it came to things like correcting his misinformation. And so now we're confronted with an administration that is probably going to continue to, upend the norms that governed how Washington operated, and they may have to find new ways of doing things in order to make sure that they are informing the public and not being distracted by the kind of insanity of the show that the Trump administration will no doubt be in the same way that the Trump campaign was.
I want to get to your prescriptions here, or at least your caveats to the press. But to what extent, though, was that dynamic also a function of the failure in the general election of Clinton making it about something other than Donald Trump as a freak and whatnot? And I would say even the Republican primary people, although part of the reason why they had trouble to make it something different is because fundamentally there wasn't a huge amount of daylight on issues between them and Trump, at least none that they wanted to talk about. And so how much of it is a function of incumbent upon the Democrats now to set the parameters in some way in the way that Trump is critiqued?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. In retrospect, we can see what the weaknesses in Clinton's strategy were. And one of the things that she didn't do was to use what has always been the most effective argument for Democrats, which is that the Republican Party is a party that is on the side of the rich and is doing things that will help rich people.
Right.
Clinton campaign made a calculation that they would be able to pull over moderate Republicans if instead of that they argued basically that, like, this guy is crazy,
right,
and that he's unfit and, he shouldn't be let anywhere near the nuclear codes and all of those things. So they made a calculation that was going to be more effective. There was more to be gained by trying to pull over those moderate Republicans than there was in making that kind of traditional Democratic argument. It turned out in the end that didn't work, that Republicans stayed with their candidate. At the time, it seemed like a perfectly reasonable strategy. It also seemed reasonable when, for long stretches, the Clinton campaign basically decided that they were going to let Donald Trump dominate the news on the theory that he was only going to hurt himself when he was on the front pages every day saying the latest outrageous thing. At the time, that seemed pretty smart because he looked so crazy and his approval ratings were so low. But in the end, we can look back and say that was probably a mistake, that they could have been making that argument. And in the end, she said a bunch of different things about him, and he had one very coherent argument to make, this idea of making America great again. You may disagree with it, but it was simple, easy to understand. It told a story about what was wrong with the country and where he wanted to take it. And
I don't want to relitigate the Clinton thing too much. I also think that, you know, the calculation wasn't just that it was the best way to win. They wanted to fashion a win because they were looking past the election. I think there's some evidence for that in terms of Chuck Schumer going around in October talking about Paul Ryan, Hillary Clinton, and Chuck Schumer. Spoke about himself in the third person, are going to make a big, more or less a grand bargain on tax repatriation and corporate tax and whatnot. But let's leave that aside for a moment. What does it tell us that Democrats need to do? If it was the case that for whatever reason, Hillary Clinton followed an incorrect strategy in trying to defeat Donald Trump, what is that message sent to Democrats today? How much of that has to be, they also have to be involved. And I want to get to what you've suggested, because I think it's very important. But I wonder how much do Democrats have to set the parameters around politics? And maybe in some instances, Bernie Sanders going around saying, I would love it if Donald Trump kept his promise and we all get health insurance and deductibles are basically gone. That would be great. I mean, in terms of ultimately defeating Donald Trump and the Republicans and having them at war with each other, which would certainly help. How much do Democrats have a responsibility to set the tenor, at least of the coverage, to help the press who can't seem to help themselves?
Yeah, well, the analogy with what the administration is going to be doing in governing is that instead of continuing to argue that Donald Trump is a nut or he's unbalanced or he's going to, you know, do crazy things, the argument that they can make is, here's what the effect is on your life of the things that they are now doing. And so it's a much more kind of practical set of arguments. So instead of, you know, like this is Donald Trump's latest crazy tweet, you know, Democrats might do a lot better. And we're seeing that right now to argue that they're about to take health coverage away from 20 million people.
Right.
And now that the Republicans have control of government, they can no longer escape accountability. The things that they're going to do are actually going to affect people's lives. And so that I think is going to end up being the most fruitful avenue for Democrats, because, you know, it's easy for Republicans to say, oh, you know, Obamacare is terrible, and to kind of spin their way to advantage when they don't have to be responsible for any of the decisions they make. But you can get a certain distance with spin, but when you take someone's health insurance away, you can't convince them that they now have something terrific.
Indeed.
You know, there's kind of a practical reality on the ground that Republicans are now responsible for. And
all
I
right,
think
well,
that Democrats would do best to focus on those things, the actual effects of their policies.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, let's talk about then once that table is set, how the press should go about their job, because I think they're already learning that this is not going to be business as usual. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Paul Waldman. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with Paul Waldman from the American Prospect about his piece, The News Media Has to Change or It'll Get Steamrolled by Trump. So, Paul, in the last segment we were talking about what the Democrats have to do in terms of dealing with Donald Trump, particularly in terms of creating a playing field, I guess, that is different from the one that the campaigns against him failed on, which was take it from the personal of Donald Trump being a lunatic and being an incompetent, all of which I think is a fair assessment in my mind, but take it to the implications of people's lives. In other words, politics. I mean, what real politics when it has an impact on people. But you also talk about the press and what job they got to do. So you talk about some assumptions that the press always has in dealing with the president that they may do best by jettisoning. Specifically, let's start with this. Direct questioning is a way to hold the president accountable. That's an assumption reporters have had, but you think that might not be operative.
Yeah, we saw this in Donald Trump's first press conference, you know, for a long time. And I'll admit I was doing this, too, saying, you know, he hadn't had a press conference since July. And how can a politician be held accountable if he doesn't stand up in front of reporters and get questioned on policy and about his actions and his words? And if you don't have the opportunity to do that, then he's kind of skating away without being held responsible. And when he finally decided to hold this press conference, one might have thought, okay, well, now there's going to be some accountability. But that press conference was, you know, yet another dumpster fire. And no one, I think, who watched that could come away feeling like he is now more accountable. You know, he got up there and told a bunch of lies and squabbled with members of the press and delivered some of his usual word salads. And at the end of it, you have to say, well, what was the point of that? Like, what did that really accomplish for the public? And so I think that if you're a White House reporter or any reporter covering politics, you have to say, well, you know, maybe, yes, it can still be important if we have the chance to do interviews with him or to do a press conference, but we shouldn't assume that that's going to really accomplish very much. I mean, if you think back to the campaign, the reporters who did the most important work were oftentimes those who were far away from the candidate. You know, someone like David Farenthold of the Washington Post, who did all this great work on Trump's foundation and exposed it for the fraud that it was. Someone like Daniel Dale from the Toronto Star, who was on the trail with Trump and every night would take the transcript of his remarks and document every lie that he told and kept this kind of running tally. And so, you know, people who were doing all this important work, not because they, you know, they got to ask him a question shouted from across a room, but because they tried to be a little bit creative and said, you know, what can I accomplish if I really set my mind to it in something that everybody else isn't doing? Now, the problem with that, though, is that it's really hard, and reporters have deadlines every single day, and it's really easy to say, this is what the president said, and here's a response from Democrats, and that's the story of the day. And doing that kind of more entrepreneurial reporting is really hard, but I think it's going to be more important than ever in Trump's Washington.
Let me just refine that a little bit, too, and get your feeling on it, because I think you're absolutely right that there's this always this sense of like we get him in a press conference. We're going to have this gotcha moment where we catch him with that. While I think that is wrong, and I think you're right that the real sort of work is to be done from afar, I have to say that now that we're moving into an era where Donald Trump, it's not just the accountability comes insofar as he is actually now part of the government. And when he gets up there in that press conference 2 weeks ago and says, we're going to do a repeal and replace, and it may be within an hour of each other or a week, but we're certainly not going to let it hang out there. Within a day, Paul Ryan had to come out and say the exact same thing. Now, I don't know how long that's going to be in effect, but that certainly forced the Republicans, it seems to me, into a box. And I know you've written about that. And part of that comes from there, where the more mundane things, I think, where we have gotten used to politicians being circumspect in their public pronouncements of what they're going to do. It's one thing he gets away with it in the campaign because there's no testing it, right? But it's another when he actually says it as president and he has to bring along a Congress. But I don't know your feeling on that. But I got to say, I think stuff like that is going to prove to be more important as we go forward. But continue on. Access is critical. Another notion that reporters have had that you think is inoperative.
Yeah, I this is something that especially in the White House, you know, there's an assumption that the closer you can get, if you can have a source that's as close as possible to the president, then you'll get some information that is true and that other people don't have, and that will enable you to get a better story and get kind of the real story. But I don't think that, you know, that was always questionable. But it's especially problematic in Trump's White House. I don't think that you know, getting to have Reince Priebus tell you what the real skinny is going to really get information that is useful to your audience if you're a journalist. You're always going to get spun. And I think particularly in this White House where, you know, from the top down, there's just this assumption that you can say whatever you want. And it doesn't really matter if you say the complete opposite 24 hours later. that that kind of access journalism is just not going to yield very much that's very interesting or very revealing. I think that especially at a time when there's so much that's going to change, you know, Republicans have been waiting for 8 years to undo the Obama presidency, and there's going to be dramatic things happening everywhere, that I think it really is incumbent upon reporters to not worry about whether or not, you know, that they're getting the blind quote from some White House staffer, but to actually go a little farther afield and figure out what the policies really turn out to be and how they're affecting people's lives. That's going to be a much more important story.
You also think that the press, and I agree with this as well, that they should jettison the idea of critiquing the spectacle as being important and follow every tweet with bated breath that the president puts out there. But with all of this said, isn't the big constraint here on journalists, to a certain extent, simply capitalism? I mean, from my perspective, I watch cable news. They're covering Donald Trump 24/7 through the campaign. But once he wins, those rallies become a lot less appealing to the viewers because he's no longer a freak show. He's actually the president. Well, how do you think that the journalists are going to be able to do what is seems to me, a much more sober, a much more difficult in many respects, and perhaps a lot less clickable job going forward?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that happened this year, is that because it was a freak show, the cable networks made a lot of money, and they found out that it was very lucrative to just stick a camera in the back of a Trump rally. And so at the same time as they were talking amongst themselves and saying that this guy is incredibly dangerous, it was also boosting their profits. Mm. And this is the perennial challenge of journalism, frankly. You know, I do think that there are ways, if you're creative enough, to do good journalism and have it be appealing to people and still make money. I mean, I write for The Washington Post, which is a profitable newspaper that has been growing and hiring staff, and I think had the best coverage of any news outlet of this campaign in America. And I'm not really a decision maker there. I'm just sort of stating my own opinions in print. But I think that that, you know, it shows that it's at least possible to assemble and build an audience while doing plenty of serious journalism. It's sometimes it's hard to do, and you're probably not going to find too much of it on cable news, unfortunately.
Paul Waldman, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Paul Waldman is a weekly columnist and senior writer for the American Prospect. He also writes for the Plumline blog at the Washington Post and The Week, and is author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. When we come back, Michael Brooks, contributor to the Majority Report and host of Two Dope Boys in a Podcast, will join us to run down the news of the week. And if you missed any part of this show, go to rofpodcast.com, sign up for our free one-hour podcast. And if you want the full show, without commercials, become a member. Your support is what helps keep Ring of Fire on the air. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm Mike Papantonio, and you've been listening to a free sample of Ring of Fire Radio. If you'd like to listen to the full show, subscribe to our weekly podcast at our website at ringoffireradio.com. It's your support that helps keep us on the air.